Accession number 23132, reel 3.
Vic Ralph, reel 3.
Yes, I was saying about the photograph I had of the long range trace from Malta. When it pointed to the north, there was the ground ray of the station, and then I think it was 50-60 miles to Sicily, and then of course there was all this mountainous region where the trace was just depressed, and there was also a return from Mount Etna there as well. And a good operator could still apparently plot through that trace, because of course once they came through all this clutter, it was only 60 miles to Malta, and it was then that the other tube that we had was called the PPI tube, and that was a rotating beam that lit up a dot. That's how it appeared at any rate. The dot, you know, came out along this trace, but it was moving as it went round, and so the dot appeared to move so you could find the path of the aircraft, and that was, you know, short in at 60 miles, and that gave a great advantage, of course, to see which direction the aircraft was coming and how many there were. You could get a very good count as well from this PPI tube, but that, of course, wasn't part of the CH equipment. This was the CHL equipment, the low flying.
PPI?
PPI tube. Post plan indicator was what it stood for. And again, you know, it was different equipment, but it didn't take long to learn to operate it. And I was most amazed, really, at how much things had been miniaturised from the old CH station. You know, the PPI was operating when I was actually in Dorset at Worth Matravers. But I never got to seeing the PPI station there, and I had seen one at Yatesbury and saw all the advantages of this auxiliary equipment, you know, auxiliary to the CH station. And there I worked as a mechanic until it was suddenly decided by the RAF that they wanted our radar station to move to Gozo, but there was nothing there on Gozo, of course, at all. So I was selected to go with a sergeant mechanic to Gozo to set up the radar station there. And off we went to Gozo. And we were billeted in Victoria. It was a sort of one-horse chief town of the area. But surprisingly enough, there was a British Institute there, which, you know, really amazed us that there should be a British Institute on Gozo. And I think I got my facts right. I'm sure it was on Gozo. But anyway, we were billeted in Victoria, and we travelled out by jeep every day to this new site in Gozo. And I remember we used to take, you know, like a picnic lunch with us, but when we got back to the hotel at night, the first course was always spaghetti, and a huge dish of spaghetti was brought in, and our Maltese driver, he used to let us have what we wanted on the plate. You know, this was only the starter. We took what we thought was a substantial helping, but what was left in the dish was probably 4 or 5 times what we had, and it was an education to us the way he made it disappear, you know. I learnt to eat spaghetti for the first time, you know. And afterwards we had, you know, a main course and a sweet or fruit to follow, and if we paid for it, we could have wine as well. So, you know, it was quite, I suppose, gentlemanly in a sense, living there for a bit. But of course we had to work hard during the day and get the station set up, and of course it had to be duly checked out and everything. And then I went back to the main station, and eventually everybody moved to Gozo.
Was it difficult setting up this new station?
Not particularly, no. You know, I mean, we had a brief of what we had to do. It was all sort of laid out for us, and I can't remember that we had any snags. If we had, you know, we could have always got in touch with somebody that could have put us right. And from Gozo, things had got a bit relaxed then, you know, the heat was off, the 8th Army had slugged its way much further north and the Germans were steadily retreating. But I think the RAF had in mind, we were never told why they wanted the station in Gozo, but my guess was that the war in the Far East was still going on, and these transports were even then going through to the Far East. And of course we could get much better plots from this station on Gozo than would have been possible from the other station on Malta.
Why?
And well, just the way where it was sited. You know, I think the Malta was probably set up just for a north-south look, but I think this was probably set up for an east-west look. It's the only thing I can think of. We were never told why at that stage of the war, you know, that the station was wanted on Gozo. But that's the only thing that I can think of. And it was to be, you know, another CHL station. It wasn't some, you know, new radar gear such as, you know, the navigational gear that I've already mentioned or anything else. Unless that was intended to come later, I don't know. And they wanted a unit already functioning there. I don't know. We were never told. But when we were on Gozo, we had the chance then, if we wanted, the RAF had taken over what I should imagine was a very upmarket hotel. It was two-thirds of the way up Mount Vesuvius, or probably more, I don't know. And if we wanted, we could go to, first of all, to a place called Taormina. Taormina, again, was a great holiday place, you know, for continental visitors pre-war, and I think post-war too. And we could stay in Taormina if we wanted, but put up, you know, at a local hotel in Taormina, or we could go on to this place, halfway up Vesuvius. And I did both. It was then that, you know, I travelled on this Italian destroyer, and I stayed at Taormina first of all, and there was lots of service in the town, and it was quite a racy sort of place, as I remember. And lots of places, the Americans were in great strength there, and they had lots of what they called snowdrops, you know, the service police with the white helmets. And they stenciled off-limits outside a lot of these establishments. And I remember quite innocently going into one, and as far as I was concerned, it seemed quite innocent there, you know, but when I got outside, I realised I'd been in a place that was off limits, and I thought, well, I'd better read more carefully by going to such establishments again. But there was also, the Greeks had been there, and there was a, I suppose you'd call it a sort of Colosseum. What's the word for it?
Parthenon?
No, you know, where the games took place and plays and whatever.
Arena?
Well, it was an arena, but I would think it was some sort of Ian, wasn't it? I seem to remember. But anyway, we went to visit that, and remember it was an unbelievably hot day, and, you know, and it was quite good to see a bit of Greek civilization. It didn't seem to be a lot of present-day civilization in Taormina, from what I could see of it. And I remember on this Italian destroyer coming back, we had very rough weather. And there was also a party from the Royal Navy aboard. And many, many people on board were seasick. I felt pretty ill myself, but I didn't actually have to run for the side. But many of the army and the RAF at the side and Wrens, but the Royal Navy types, I noticed that all of them were just lifting one eyebrow and, you know, wondering what all the fuss was about. And also members of the Italian crew. I suppose normally the Mediterranean's a bit calmer than that, although it does have very rough weather at times, but a few of those too had to run for the side too. But eventually we got back into Grand Harbour. It was Grand Harbour. That was at Valletta, you know. And all was well. And one thing that did happen when we were in Malta that I failed to mention, and that was before we had this Italian destroyer plying between Sicily and Malta, we had a motor yacht. I would believe it was a Yugoslav yacht. Again, the RAF had commandeered it. And on one occasion, it was we were still doing the same run for the benefit, you know, you got this leave from Malta. I think you had to have done a certain amount of time there before you could go on the leave, you know, to Taormina and to Etna and Vesuvius. And where was it? I've lost the thread a bit. Oh, yes, it was coming back. And I remember that it ran into trouble. And I don't know why, but they'd lost contact completely. And our radar, on the CHL, it was hand-operated, and it was geared, and you cranked this movable aerial. It was on a sort of big tripod with the operating cabin within the tripod. And, you had to crank this thing round to get it, you know, onto the aircraft, and you moved it with directions. You moved it to and fro a bit, you know, so you were dead on the incoming aircraft to get a really sort of good plot. And we were asked from the group if we could do something about it, because, you know, we'd locked our aerial because of these high winds. And we said we'll try, and the whole unit turned out from the technical side, and some got up onto the roof of the tripod, and while others were below, and together we, you know, with somebody doing their hardest to crank, with somebody pushing, we moved round our aerial round to the last place where there'd been a sighting. And eventually we did get this yacht, and we were able to give plots on it where it was. And I remember they were very pleased with us for that, and we got a mention for it, you know. We were able to get plots on this yacht, and all the people who were on it were rescued. So, and then after that, from Gozo, again, the second time it had happened to me, the operators were posted home, and the unit went care and maintenance, and I was there to get plots, you know, make sure the gear was still working and do anything that was necessary, and I was told that I was going to stay, and eventually I was going to be forwarded on to the Far East. But then the atom bomb was dropped on, while I was in Malta, by the way, VE Day came. This is, you know, another of the reasons for the station going care and maintenance. And of course there was no need for my going to the Far East. And then while the station had been operating, something I forgot to mention was that I'd become airman schoolmaster. Somebody had arrived on the unit from, you know, an officer from the education department, and he sort of singled me out and said, would you like to become airman schoolmaster? You know, it's a matter of anybody on the unit that wants, you know, really furthering the three R's, you know, maths and writing and English, you know. And so I said, yes, I'd do this. And I was surprised at the number of people on the unit, you know, who were quite keen to join. Not among the mechanics, I might say. They sort of all scorned it, you know. Someone better educated than I was, you know. But the others, you know, really sort of joined in very happily, and this went on for some time. And I remember I used to get some extra pay for doing this as well.
Is this in Malta?
This is in Malta.
In Gozo?
Mm, yeah. No, not Gozo. Can't remember if it was in Malta and Gozo, I think. Malta and Gozo, it must have been. Because then, I know my CEO had been striving for ages to get promotion for me, because, you know, I'd been doing goodness knows what, that, you know, normally it would have been expected for somebody higher up the scale to have been doing. And he got on to group and said, you know, when's this going to happen? I've asked twice for this man. And so they said, sorry, because we're getting near the end of the war in Europe, the Mediterranean area is oversubscribed with mechanics. And if you want somebody of superior rank, we'll give him to you gladly, but we can't make up any more, you know, of your existing personnel. And, you know, that mechanic you've got there, you know, I'm sorry, we can't do it. So he said, well, he said, he's the one that knows about it. He said, you send somebody else in and he won't know the gear at all. He'd have come off something else in radar, come from, you know, airborne gear or something of that sort. He said, he's the one that I want. And so they said, you can keep anybody else. I'll carry on with him. But then, because of my being airman schoolmaster, I was invited to become a sergeant EVT instructor. Now, EVT stands for Educational Vocational Training. And to do this, I would go to Egypt. And in Egypt, I would get this, change completely, not do radar. And I was a bit regretful of that, but become full-time educational and vocational training. But then, while I was waiting for this to happen, my DMOB came up. And I then had a very difficult choice, whether to go home or to sign on. I think it wasn't a very lengthy signing, but I know I had to sign on for further service in the RAF to become an educational and vocational training sergeant.
Did you do that?
In the end, I didn't. No, I opted to go back. And strange enough, it didn't end there, because when I got back, I was one of the lucky ones. I had three jobs open to me. I could have gone on back into Petrofina, into the accounts department. What was the other one? Oh, yes. I'd already thought it was unfair to hold my job with Petrofina, and I'd already sort of phoned them and said that I wouldn't be coming back. And this is when I got back, you know. And they said, never mind that you've resigned, you know, we'd be glad to have you back. But I'd already signed up with a local firm to become a sort of bonus clerk timekeeper with a building firm while I waited. I'd been interviewed by the Ministry of Education, and I'd already waiting for a place at a college of education, in a training college, they call them, in this country. But it was a long time coming. It was 2 years in the end, and I thought, rather than, you know, getting in civilian radar in northern France or go back to the accounts department job, it would be better to take this sort of local job in the hope that this vacancy would occur at a training college. And in the event, one came up after 2 years, and I went to Eastbourne Training College. And there I met a lot of other ex-servicemen training to become school teachers.
Why had you not decided to become an EVT instructor?
Because it meant signing up for a further length of duty. I've got a feeling it might only have been a year, but at the same time, you know, the carrot of going back and getting on with what I'd signed up for with the Ministry of Education. I'd already had somebody come and pick me out on the unit and interviewed me, you know, for becoming a teacher. And it seemed like a good idea. And so I'd signed up with the Ministry of Education.
Did you ever come across German POWs?
Oh, yes, I'd forgotten to mention that. That was with this building firm that I worked for. It was my job on this building firm to... first of all, I had a hut on a site at Selsdon, just outside Croydon. And it was my job, all the English personnel who were employed by the firm I worked for, Walker Tooting they were called, and it was my job to run a time clock and clock them all in the morning, and then work out their wages. And then also some of the work was on bonus, and in the building trade they had strange things like wait time and stoppage time, and I had to credit them with that as well, because, you know, there were all sorts of things. When they were doing their specialist time, they got a higher rate than when they were on wet time or stoppage time, you know. So I had to keep note of all these things. And at the end of the week, I used to have to work out these wage sheets that went to the head office for checking. And then they would make up their pay packets. And then they would bring the pay packets out to me. And then I would pay the men out from my hut, you know, and they would... check their pay and then come back on me if I got anything wrong, you know. So that was my first job for this building firm. But then in time they extended it. They had lots of other small sites. They were doing the expansion joints on the runway at Biggin Hill, for instance, which the RAF had vacated, and it had now become a small sort of civilian airfield. And I think the RAF probably had some input to it, but certainly not on the scale when it was a fighter station, you know. And my firm had to have these expansion joints that they repaired, measured up, and I was the one who had to do it, measure up, you know, how much yardage of expansion joints that they'd done there. And they also had other sites that had to have their wages worked out and you know, the same thing done as Selsdon. But Selsdon, the time that I worked for, was the main site, and it was there that they had this big German POW workforce. And you know, at that time, I remember all the site personnel who were ex-servicemen. They had nothing against the German soldiers and Air Force, you know. They were just doing the same job as we'd done, and they'd been called up, you know, as most of ours had been called up, you know. Few volunteers, I suppose, on their side too, but you know, we didn't bear each other any grudges. And I remember that there was one man working there who, you know, it turned out that he was a BMW mechanic, and the young site agent that we had a BMW motorbike, and of course he was soon sidetracked into this BMW motorbike, and I should think it must have been the best tuned BMW in the British Isles at that time. You know, there weren't too many of them about. So, and others of them, in their spare time, they used to do woodcraft of various sort, make excellent toys and whatever, and they used to sell those to get a bit extra, you know, and they always very willing to give any personal help that they could, as well as helping forward the erection of the prefabricated houses on the site.
Were there ever any hard feelings because of the war?
None whatsoever, no. And it was that site as well where it became a morass in the winter, and you know, parts of it you almost needed thigh boots. But the people who came into the erected prefabs were desperate, and many of them were living in army Nissen huts, you know. And nearly all the women were pregnant. And when they arrived on site, they were put in the prefabs, but often they rarely got out, you know, in this winter when the site was in such a poor condition. And it was no uncommon thing. The site agent quite gladly cooperated. When it was needed, the district nurse would arrive at the site entrance and would immediately shout to somebody that she wanted a help, and one of these big tired vehicles, or even a track vehicle if one was handy, would turn up, and the district nurse would get up in the cab along with the driver and drive across this morass to deliver the baby, you know. And when she came out again, all was well, you know, those roundabout give a little cheer sort of thing, you know. That was a sort of atmosphere there was on the site.
How do you feel now about having served in the RAF in the Second World War?
Good vibes all the way through. And as I say, it didn't really directly result in my meeting my wife, but there was a little connection with it, that after the war, I don't know if I could say the war was to blame in any way. My mother died in that time, you know, I'd only been back a few months and she died, and I suppose I'd put up with some grotty food as well one way and another, and I was getting a lot of stomach pain, and my doctor decided that I probably had an ulcer, and I was living then in Purley. I had an ulcer, he said, but you'll have to go up to Charing Cross Hospital for an x-ray. So I duly went up to Charing Cross, and I was then down, as I told you, to go on a Ministry of Education course at a training college, and I wanted some books from the education office in Kingsway. And I arrived early for this x-ray at Charing Cross, and I went to Kingsway. And it was before I got to Kingsway, it was in the road, there's a theatre there just that leads into Kingsway. I don't know what it's called. Off the Strand. I don't think it's the Strand itself, it's a little joint.
Aldwych.
Aldwych, yeah. And I was walking along Aldwych, and I passed a girl, and I thought, I know her, Shepperton. And I hadn't gone, you know, this flashed in my mind, hadn't gone more than two paces, and I spun round, and she spun round too. She remembered as well. And we took it from there.
Do you think the ulcer was because of war?
Oh, yes, you'd never have arrived at Shepperton, neither would I, if it hadn't been for the war.
No, it was the ulcer because of the war?
The stomach. Didn't have an ulcer. When I went to, after this we arranged a meeting, naturally, you know, and I went back to Charing Cross Hospital and went into hospital, and a horrible sight, when I was led into this room, confronted my eye. We were all given, all those who were there of all ages and sexes, were given a tube and a bowl. And what we had to do ourselves was to push the end of the tube. It was suitably shaped, I remember, was to push the tube down our, what is it, esophagus, I suppose, isn't it, the eating tube. And of course, this meant that the purpose of the bowl was meant that lots of people with this action, you know, were heaving and bringing out the contents of their last meal. And it was really quite gruesome. And, you know, those that were having extreme difficulty were getting a little assistance. But, you know, obviously the same problem must have existed then with nurses as it did now. And anyway, when the tubes were in place, as soon as your tube was in place, the stomach contents were torn off for analysis, you know. And I believe we then, some stage, I believe we had an x-ray. Perhaps we had it first or after, I don't know. But anyway, we had the x-ray too. And the result that came through for mine was just that it was acid indigestion of some sort, you know. And take suitable medicine.